an attention-getting story on MLive today that I have to drop in here. Apparently, a man in Ionia County woke up to find himself laying in the middle of M21 in Ionia Township, apparently with no recollection of how he got there. Authorities in Ionia County are now asking for help in identifying or tracing the whereabouts of Kyle Robertson. This is according to MLive. Kyle Robertson, age 23, and this happened yesterday morning. He advised police he found himself lying in the road on East Blue Water Highway, that's M21 and 4th Street in Ionia Township, 10:46 p.m. This was late last week. Non-life-threatening injuries took him to Sparrow Hospital. Senator Jones, you ever, in all your years in law enforcement, you must have encountered something like this once or twice.
In 31 years, I saw many cases like this. Alcohol is a poison, and it occasionally causes blackouts if people have too much. I try to preach everything in moderation.
Okay. Well, Senator Rick Jones is indeed our lead guest here today on Current State. We are here to talk about all kinds of issues. The state legislature's summer break begins later this week. That has meant, of course, a surge of activity this week to finish a new state budget and to further address one of the state's biggest issues, road funding. Senator Jones joins us now to discuss those and his measure that would amend Michigan law on strip searches. Great to see you today.
Good to see you.
The legislature wraps up here later this week. The governor wants a road funding measure on his desk by the end of the week. Is road funding dead or alive for this session?
Well, it's very much alive, and I hope it can be accomplished. There's three things on the table. The House passed a change to wholesale tax, sent it to the Senate. Basically, that would raise a gallon of gas 20 cents over the next 3 or 4 years. The leader of the Senate, Randy Richardville, has suggested that is not enough money, and he is correct, it's not enough. And he has suggested a formula that would raise your gas tax on gasoline per gallon about 45 cents over 4 years. The other option out there is putting a penny sales tax on the ballot. Now, I favor that. 1% sales tax locked into roads and bridges could not be transferred away. And, for example, this morning I talked in a coffee shop to numerous people, and they overwhelmingly support 1 penny sales tax. They don't like the other options. One senior says, I'm on a fixed income. I have a fixed pension. I have Social Security. He says, every year I see my buying power go down. Please, he said, don't raise the gas. Don't raise my license plate. I talked to a waitress who was a single mom. She says, my biggest expenses are food and rent and gasoline to get to work. She said, I don't care if you raise sales tax. I don't buy much. And Michigan doesn't tax food anyway. So she says, that's the way to do it. Don't raise my gasoline.
It's interesting, though, because there are critics who claim the sales tax, increasing the sales tax would be regressive.
Yes, typically, that is the Democrat mantra, that sales tax is regressive. But if you actually go out and talk to the working poor, they will tell you sales tax doesn't bother. It's this single mom. She says, I get most of my clothing from my children at Goodwill or St. Vincent's. I don't spend a lot in sales tax, but I sure have to buy a lot of food, and I have to pay my rent. Those are my two biggest expenses, and they're not taxed.
I mean, which of these three proposals will be the first to go?
You know, it's hard to say.
Think Senator Richardville's has got the support to go all the way? It would appear doubtful.
He didn't last week. We'll see today. It'll start at 10 o'clock.
Okay. And some of these potholes are being filled. Do you think these incremental improvements in the state's roads might be enough to take road funding? I mean, now we're forced to consider, what if this doesn't move forward? What if it doesn't reappear until later in the year? Are these incremental improvements in the state's roads enough to really take it off the front burner for a while?
I think it does with a lot of people. For example, last week we voted that all of the sales tax collected on gasoline would go to roads if it wasn't the portion that goes to K-12 or to revenue sharing. So that's a start. That's probably $125 million, something like that.
I think a lot of people were surprised to learn how much of the taxes that are paid at the gas pump did not go to roads.
That's true.
That is something of a breakthrough, really, when that was when we learned that, was it not?
Well, a lot of people tell me, just take all the sales tax produced by gasoline and put it into roads. And then I explained to them that creates an $800 million hole in K-12 and about $250 million in revenue sharing, and we simply can't take that much away from those.
Does the sales tax proposal have more support than Senator Richardville's, do you think?
I think it's 50-50 right now.
Real kind of interesting. I want to ask you about the new report from the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. It suggests that the state law that requires 17-year-olds to be charged as adults is not good for teens and isn't making the public safer. I know you're aware of the report. What do you make of that?
Well, I think as a whole, I want to see teens put into rehab, rehabilitation, make them productive children. But we have to be aware that we have some teens that are so psychologically damaged, you would never want them in society again. Two quick examples. We had one teen who murdered a man, he said, because he wanted to see what it felt like. He then cut his head off, took pictures of it, put it in his car, and drove it around. That is not a man I ever want to see in society. Another quick example.
He was how old?
He was 16, I believe. These are all cases that were told to me by prosecutors. Another three young men kidnapped a young lady, drove her around, showing her to gang members as a trophy in their back seat, then continued on into the night, raped her, and murdered her. Somebody that commits a crime so heinous, I don't believe, belongs back in our society.
Kristen Staley is with the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency, which compiled this study. She made an interesting comment yesterday suggesting some number of your fellow Republicans are saying they are interested in pretty serious reforms to the juvenile justice system. Let's listen.
Across the nation, there's been a change in terms of conservatives leading the reforms to actually de-incarcerate, to bring more people out of the prison system and more people back into the community so that they can be productive, so they can have jobs, so they can, you know, pay their taxes.
Senator Jones, do you detect the trend that she is talking about? Is that alive in the Michigan legislature?
Well, yes. Joe Haveman from Holland area is very conservative, and he believes truly in his heart that most people are rehabilitated and ready to go back out. However, as a former jail administrator and a sheriff, I can tell you within 1 month, every inmate picks up a Bible, writes a letter to the judge, and says, I have been saved. Please let me out. But when you let them out, it's only about 2% that change.
Mm. The adult time for adult crime measure was signed into law 18 years ago this month, if I remember correctly. Couldn't it be argued that it's worth a review to see how it's working? Or are you convinced it already is working?
You know, I'm willing to review anything, but talk to the victims' families of some of these horrible crimes where people have been tortured and murdered. And then you tell me you want this guy back in society next to your son or daughter. I think not.
Senator Rick Jones is our guest. We're talking about legislative issues. You recently introduced a bill on your committee, Judiciary, that would amend a longstanding law on strip searches in Michigan. This law has been on the books in Michigan since 1927. Explain what your measure would do.
Well, the Michigan Sheriff's Association came to me. They represent 83 sheriffs across the state. And they said our jails are becoming progressively more and more dangerous. We have people coming in with knives, occasionally a gun, razor blades taped to their leg, drugs, very, very common for people to come in with drugs. Now, what does that cause you? It causes you to have more suicides and assaults on other inmates and corrections officers. So the Michigan Safe Jail Act simply says that even if somebody comes in for a misdemeanor, the jail would have the right to make sure that they are searched, and that would mean that they would be searched unclothed by an officer of the same sex. Now, typically in my jail, you would be asked to put on jail clothes. And so if you were concealing something, usually it fell to the ground and it could be retrieved and the jail made secure. It's not just drugs that the inmate is going to use. They can crush them up and put them into other inmates' food and drink. That's one thing I've seen. I've seen a man come in with a, instead of underwear, a bathing suit. He took the string out, the cord, wrapped it around his neck and attempted suicide. We saved him at the last second. This is the sort of thing that a jail administrator has to worry about, the safety of everybody. And I tell people, if you're against searching somebody, strip searching them, how would you feel if your son or daughter, age 18, 19, went in for drunk driving and the inmate next to them had a knife and cut their throat? That's the fact. That could happen.
Are there certain kinds of misdemeanors that you would focus on in this measure, or does it include all of them, or how does that break down?
The problem is you have no idea who the person truly is. I mean, you may have arrested them because they have a warrant on them for not paying a traffic ticket, but they could have concealed a knife or drugs or occasionally a gun on their person. And it happens all the time. As police walk up, typically what does the guy do that's holding something inappropriate? They stick it in their pants, hoping the officer won't find it.
Does this happen regularly, though? I mean, how common is this?
I have personally seen it. I was a officer on the street. I was a sergeant on the street. I later became a jail administrator, then a sheriff. I have seen it all. This is very common.
It is very common. Okay. What are you hearing from opponents about this?
Well, you know,
what do you make of the other
opponents
side?
The opponents are, oh, this is a violation of my rights, and I shouldn't be, you know, searched if you take me into jail for a misdemeanor. And again, I say, if it was your son or daughter in there for some minor offense and the inmate next to them had a knife and hurt them, cut their throat, stabbed them, wouldn't you want that jail to have done their job? The simplest way is to have an officer of the same sex, simply ask them to change clothing to jail clothing, and normally everything falls to the ground at that point.
What is the status of your measure right now? It was just introduced May 27th.
It's simply an introduced bill. It may or may not go through the system. Again, I put it in at the request of the Michigan Sheriff's Association because they want jails to be safer, not just for the officers, but also for the inmates.
Is there a companion bill in the House?
There is not.
Do you know?
There is not.
Okay. And how can you, I mean, tell us about the response so far. On the committee.
This hasn't been brought up in front of the committee. Oh. The only response I'm aware of is the American Civil Liberties Union came out in the media and opposed it, then challenged me to a debate on Fox TV on Sunday, and then withdrew the challenge and told the host of the show, Mr. Langton, we've decided we don't want to take on Jones.
Did you make it to the Mackinac Policy Conference?
I did. And
what was the takeaway for you from your visit there?
The takeaway from there was that everybody believes Detroit will turn around. Businesses are coming in and buying up large sections of Detroit. They're refurbishing buildings. They're making condos. They're making businesses. Quicken is one of the biggest companies. It's in there gobbling up property. Detroit's going to turn around.
But you were an opponent of the grand bargain, correct?
I am, because I simply wanted them to go through the bankruptcy. I felt that was the best way to start over.
Any response to the photo here of this really made the rounds late last week, and I have to ask you about it. The photo of representatives Victory, Glardon, and Battaglia with the fashion magazines joking, don't say we don't understand women.
Well, it's kind of strange. They were actually set up by a colleague who was a female representative, and she gave them her glamour magazines and said, here, hold these. I want to take a picture of you. And so she was joking around in a break between voting. And then somebody from the media also snapped a picture, and so all of a sudden they're in national news. Well, of course, the opposition party tried to make a big deal out of it. You're going to see a lot of this in an election year. And I'm a common sense Republican. And I can tell you this happens on both sides, you know, where they try to pick at somebody's doing something like this. And it's an election year.
The budget process has taken longer this fall, this spring, summer, than it has in the past.
Not by much. I can tell you, I served three terms in the House under Governor Granholm, and we always went till midnight, October 1. And I can tell you that one time they actually put a blanket over the clock saying that time had stopped, and because they still hadn't quite settled the budget, Under this governor, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, the budget gets done in a timely fashion. It's going to be done the end of this week. That is a huge improvement. Why? Because every K-12 school has to have their budget done in July. And if they don't know how much money they're going to get, how can they possibly do a rational budget? So been very successful under these 4 years getting the budget done in a timely fashion.
What's your summer like? I mean, after this week, it's big break for everybody. I think there's two sessions a month planned for the next couple of months. What do you get done typically in the summertime?
Well, it's funny. A lot of people in the media say you're going to be on vacation all summer. I'm taking only 1 week, the first week of July. I'll be working every other week on trying to make Michigan a better place and a safer place and have more jobs.
Senator Rick Jones chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. He is from Grand Ledge. Thanks for joining us.
Have a great day.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Around the world, aquaculture is one of the fastest growing food production systems. However, that's not the case in the U.S. or Michigan. Here, aquaculture remains a relatively small industry used to grow aquatic plants or produce fish for stocking. While Michigan's aquaculture industry is small, some see potential and believe that aquaculture could become an important industry in the state. However, there are some environmental concerns over expanding the practice here in Michigan. To learn more, current state's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Jim Diana, a director of the Michigan Sea Grant and a professor of fisheries and aquaculture at the University of Michigan.
Break it down for us. What is aquaculture? What are we talking about when we say aquaculture?
Well, aquaculture is the growing of some kind of an aquatic crop. It could be plants or animals. It could be all sorts of animals, including fish. And it could be growing throughout the entire life cycle, from rearing young in captivity all the way up to harvesting an adult. Or it could just be rearing a part of their life history, like rearing young animals and then stocking them out in the wild. All of that would be part of what we'd call aquaculture.
So globally, aquaculture is one of the fastest growing food commodities, but that's not necessarily the case in the United States. Why hasn't aquaculture picked up in the U.S.?
Well, for one, we don't really have a good history of it. If you go to Southeast Asia or Polynesia, you find efforts of aquaculture have continued for thousands of years. We've only been at it for a relatively short time, probably about 30 years. At least in a very intensive way. Secondly, I think that it's hard for many of the American producers to compete with foreign labor and limited costs that they have for aquaculture products. And then I think thirdly, there's been difficulties in just getting through all of the kinds of regulations and rules that we have to be able to establish facilities.
There are several different environmental concerns related to aquaculture. Could you take us deeper into some of the potential environmental impacts that, the DEQ or the DNR might address?
One of our issues is people worry about things in aquaculture that they don't necessarily worry about equally in agriculture, and almost consider that aquaculture ought to be pure and clean, whereas agriculture obviously is going to have impacts as we grow food. So they're not necessarily even compared fairly. But, you know, for aquaculture, we run water through a system, so we use water. Most of that water is returned to natural waters, changed because it's gone through the animals and plants that live in the facility. So it can have higher levels of nutrients. It can have higher levels of solids that come from the feed and the fecal matter that the animals produce. Could be altered in temperature. And then beyond that, the animals might and plants might end up generating some kind of disease organisms that could be transferred to animals living wild. They might escape themselves and influence the community of the receiving waters. Those are probably the main impacts that the DNR or DEQ in Michigan would be concerned about related to aquaculture.
What does the Michigan aquaculture landscape look like anyway? What's the size of it? We said the U.S. is small. I imagine that it's similar in Michigan.
It's very small in Michigan, probably a total of maybe $5 million a year right now. Rainbow trout probably dominates the industry. There's also a sort of a nascent industry in producing marine shrimp. There's a lot of aquaculture that goes into things like bait fish and stock fish to stock out into natural systems rather than food. And actually, probably that's more of the aquaculture today than food production in the state of Michigan.
So right now you said it's about $5 million. What economic role could aquaculture play in Michigan?
Well, I work for Michigan Sea Grant, and Sea Grant commissioned a group to do a study on aquaculture and to come up with a strategic plan together with the aquaculture industry. Their strategic plan is proposing $1 billion annually by 2025. Now, that's pretty optimistic in most people's minds, but certainly it's not beyond what's happened in other countries and other places.
The DEQ is currently reviewing a request for a hatchery near Grayling to expand from producing 20,000 pounds of fish per year to eventually producing 300,000 pounds per year. And groups along the Asaba River are concerned about the fishery, you know, threatening the river's health. While I'm sure it's different in each case, this kind of brings up the broader policy question of how to safely expand aquaculture. What types of standards or practices should be developed to create an ecologically sensitive aquaculture practices in the state?
So there are pretty well-established best practices to deal with things like nutrients in the water that's discharged, water use, solids in the water that's discharged, control of disease, things of that sort. They differ for the kind of species grown. The example in Grayling, they're going to grow rainbow trout. The state is put into their permit application the idea that they can only get to a certain level of effluent in terms of phosphorus and total dissolved solids, which are the two parts they're regulating. They would need to monitor that regularly and obviously manage the system so they don't exceed those effluent guidelines. Additionally, the groups that are concerned about the Asaba River, and I should say that it's a good thing that there are groups that are interested in this and that they bring forth their concerns, because that's the best way for aquaculture to adjust to and consider those concerns. Anyway, they are worried about genetic impacts of released fish, and so as a result, they're going to use triploid trout that are not fertile, or at least the great majority of them are not fertile. And then, similarly, they're worried about disease, so they're using specific pathogen-free organisms that have been at least originally started in a very clean and disease-free environment. So those are the kinds of practices that are being regulated. In addition to that, if you're running an aquaculture firm, the lower the food conversion rate, the amount of food applied to get a certain amount of growth, the better the system is in terms of its impact on water quality and all of those things we just talked about. And that's something that's really more of the industry's case. It's also something that obviously the more food you feed to grow fish to a certain size, the more it costs you to grow them. So there's a big industry incentive at reducing feed input as well.
So with the Sea Grant, you guys have worked on this report looking at the potential for aquaculture in Michigan as an industry. I guess, what does that industry look like? What do you envision it looking like 10 years from now?
Well, the first step will be things like what just is happening in Grayling, where we might see taking over of formerly either not run well or not very productive facilities and expanding production. The advantage of that is obviously the structures are already there, and then there's the ability to just, the impact has already been there in some ways as well. The next step would be looking at probably three or four different kinds of aquaculture systems and trying to set up demonstrations and production methodologies for those. Those systems would probably include the raceway system for trout like Grayling, probably include the recirculating aquaculture systems indoors, which would be more focused on warmer water species that can't tolerate our winters. And then there is a proposal for cage culture in the Great Lakes and in maybe inland waters as well. And that all three of those are probably important components of the future of aquaculture in Michigan. And that could occur both in rural settings, where there's a lot of opportunity right now, and also in urban settings like Detroit and Saginaw, where there's a real interest in trying to establish agriculture types of industries and use, repurposing of either manufacturing or housing that's there.
How do you see aquaculture playing into the local food movement?
I think that the whole emphasis we have that the Michigan Aquaculture Association has done, the Michigan Department of Ag and Rural Development, and the DNR is to focus on increasing food production through aquaculture, because we're going to have 9 billion people in the world fairly soon, and we're estimating there's going to be a fairly significant protein shortage unless food production increases. And one of the places it can increase is in aquaculture, because as you said earlier, it's the fastest growing food production system in the world right now. So it's going to focus on food production. And I think that it fits very well with the local food movement, because a lot of people are concerned about the quality of food that comes from, say, Chinese growing of tilapia or Thai growing of shrimp, both in terms of the food quality, is it really handled well, and also in terms of the environmental impacts that occur there. We in the United States regulate those a lot more strictly, and so people would be a lot more, assured that they're getting a quality crop grown in a better way if it were grown locally. So I think that it fits very well to that system. And people also think about things like food miles, and obviously that makes a big difference in terms of it being grown here versus shipped over from China.
Jim Diana is the director of the Michigan Sea Grant College Program. He is also a professor of fisheries and aquaculture at U of M School of Natural Resources and the Environment. Jim, thanks for your time.
Great. Thank you very much.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
Don't forget you can follow Current State on Twitter at KAR Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Summer Circle Theater at Michigan State University is entering its 54th season this week. And Current State Scott Pohl is here with a look at the schedule and a look ahead at the theater's plan for the future. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. It's a good morning to be here with you. Summer Circle Theater has been around for a long time. They put on student productions of plays outdoors around the MSU Auditorium and Fairchild Theater. I say around because the site has moved from time to time.
Okay.
This will be the last season, though, of that kind of nomadic existence. Work has begun on a permanent home for Summer Circle. I talked with Associate Professor of Theater Rob Rosnowski, who runs Summer Circle and wrote one of the plays on the schedule this year. We started with a look at What I Did Last Summer by A.R. Gurney. That's the play that kicks off the season on Wednesday night.
What I Did Last Summer takes place in 1945 on the lakes of Lake Erie. This family, the husband, the father, is off at the war, and the family's trying to deal with what it's like without a male influence in the family, and what the young boy, how he sort of rebels in that summer. And he meets a bohemian art teacher, and she opens his eyes to a different way of living. It's a really interesting play.
Detroit is by Lisa D'Amore, and so I want to talk about that specifically since mm-hmm. it's called Detroit. There might be a special interest for Detroiters who are right. in the Lansing area this year. Tell me about Detroit.
Detroit is a very allegorical adult play. It's about people in the suburbs outside of a city that might be Detroit. And it's people living in a lovely home next to a house that's been abandoned. And how the people that move into that abandoned home, are they squatters? Are they people that own or rent the home? And so it's this mystery of the disintegration of the American dream, I think.
Detroit is June 18th to the 21st. Ruthless is on the schedule this year, starting on June 25th. Book and lyrics by Joel Paley and music by Marvin Laird. What's Ruthless about?
Ruthless is about 8-year-old Tina Denmark, who wants desperately to play the lead in her school musical of Pippi Longstocking. And it is a spoof of things like The Bad Seed and Gypsy and Valley of the Dolls. And it's this very campy, very funny musical about ambition and being ruthless in the business.
Do you have a child playing yeah. that role?
Yes, we do. She's a local student. So we have several people from the community in some of our shows in either older roles or younger roles.
The Summer Circle, as it's appropriately called, written by one Rob Rosnowski. Tell me about the Summer Circle. You wrote this. It's named for the yes. Summer Circle Theater. Would yeah. that be correct?
That is correct. It's the entirely fictitious way in which Summer Circle Theater started. And it was written to be a companion piece to, or actually to present the opening of our new space, which won't happen until next year, but we decided to do it anyway. It's a bunch of kids that meet at a lake one summer and start to do free theater for people.
Now, the Summer Circle runs on several different pairs of nights, mm-hmm. June 13th and 14th, the 20th and 21st, and the 27th and 28th. And then there's one last show that we need to talk about. It's called The Weird by Roberto Aguirre Sacasa. Hoping I'm getting that mm-hmm. right. The Weird. Tell me about this.
It's a collection of short one-act plays that are that combine horror movies with updated theatrical styles. So there's a 10-minute play about Rosemary's Baby that's a mix of Edward Albee and Rosemary's Baby. There's a play that's sort of a swamp thing that meets Tennessee Williams. So it's really interesting. That's a late night show as well. And so there's the kids show at 6:30, then a main stage show at 8, and then a late night show at 10. And so you can sit here and watch free theater for several hours. I just love it.
Three shows in one night, a triple feature.
Exactly. And you'll see actors, you know, in different shows and different styles in the same night. It's very fun.
It is important to point out that some of the late night shows aren't appropriate for the kids, and that's why they're late night, I suppose. But
exactly.
If you bring the kids, it might be time to take them home before those shows begin.
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. Is there a theme to this year's shows uniting these programs?
Well, it was... This season was chosen to celebrate the opening of the new stage. That's not happening this year. So the theme was sort of moving forward about, you know, celebrating the idea and art of theater. So that's what the thematic tie is.
All right. Now I want to clarify for people, being student productions largely mm-hmm. in the summer, and we've talked about this in the past, but refresh my memory about casting student productions in the summer. Lots of students go home for the summer. Do we have some actors in more than one of these shows? How does that play out when you're casting the Summer Circle programs?
Sure. Summer Circle has become a tradition in the department. People love to be part of it. Not only are the students paid, but they're also doing several shows at once. So the rehearsal schedule is a nightmare, as you can imagine, rehearsing 5 shows and opening them within 3 weeks of each other. So the students are all, it's one of a coveted role, I think, to be in Summer Circle. It's a tradition here.
Well, we're standing on this year's site, which is the last summer that Summer Circle Theater will be in, you'd have to say, a temporary site because it has moved around over the years.
Exactly.
We have a small stage that's been built between the MSU auditorium and a couple of set of bleacher seats. There's also room for folding chairs and that sort of thing for folks who want that kind of comfort level when they come to Summer Circle Theater. But this is the last year that it's going to be moving around. And I know that you're excited about the new permanent construction that's underway that we're going to go see. But is there also a little melancholy about the last time you're going to work under these circumstances? It's okay to say no.
I'm going to say no to that. That's okay. Only because, I mean, it really is just this, being my 10th year here, it's noticing, you know, just the bugs and the actual infrastructure that we have to create each summer, you know what I mean, is just really takes a lot of time away from when we could be doing good work in the theater or in the show. So, no, I'm not really that sad about that, but because I think the new space is so interesting.
And being between the auditorium and the Red Cedar River, it comes with the perils of mosquitoes and traffic going by. I can see the famous MSU Rock off in the distance. Lots of traffic around Summer Circle shows when people don't even know what's going on over here.
That's true. It's amazing to me that people don't know because it's been going on for such a long time. And to me, you see the same people every summer coming in. It's such a tradition and such an East Lansing tradition. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing when people don't know about this great free theater.
Well, I'll just make it clear to people that it's on the south side of the auditorium building between the auditorium and the Red Cedar River. Now, we are not too far from the construction site of the permanent Summer Circle Theater location. Let's start with the whole process of getting that going, including raising money to do it, the funding for it and everything. It's obvious why you wanted such a site, but what were some of the challenges that had to be overcome?
Well, I think the main one obviously was funding and getting, I think, the university to get on board with the plan because it really happened quite quickly. You know, the plans were drawn up and then we just started fundraising and through several private donors as well as corporate donors and fundraising from the Friends of Theater, which is our group that is, you know, supports the theater here. It's really been a quick process, actually. So it should be done. The stage should be done sometime this summer, not in time for the opening. But yeah, it's been a difficult thing. We're still seeking funds, finishing it. So we're still ready to accept anyone's donation to help out there.
Well, let's take a walk and see what's there at this point and look forward to the future.
So, yeah, this is the, it's going to be in the courtyard in front of the Kresge Art Building and right by the entrance to the Fairchild Theater in the auditorium. So it's right there in that plaza. So we sort of call it an arts corridor between art and theater.
Well, there's that unmistakable construction sound, Rob.
Yes, exactly. That's music to my ears.
Well, Rob, here we are on the east side of the building, which people will remember is the Fairchild Theater side of the auditorium building. And I see earth movers and work underway. Tell me what this design is going to look like when it's finished.
Absolutely. I think that one of the issues has been where we were, that it wasn't accessible to everyone. So this will be an accessible space to people with disabilities and older people. So that's one of the main primary reasons for creating this new courtyard. It will have a circle stage to represent, obviously, Summer Circle. And throughout it, there will be a mixture of porous ground cover as well as grass ground cover. So depending on what the weather and the day will be like, you can see they kept a lot of the trees to keep the integrity of the historic nature of it.
Are you saying that the productions will be in the round? There will be seating on all four sides?
No, just the stage is round. The seating will be, it's circular feel.
Semicircle.
Right? Semicircle. Maybe,
okay.
If you want. Yeah.
And when you say that, is it cement? Is it seating cut into it in some fashion? How is the seating going to work?
The seating is both, there's both bench seating as well as people can keep bringing their, you know, lawn chairs and things like that.
And what will you do for lighting? Will there be permanent lighting fixtures, or is that going to be temporary equipment that comes and goes as needed?
The equipment will be brought in and out for it, but there'll be places there to plug in to complete our infrastructure so we don't have to rebuild it every year.
Yeah. Will it have other uses besides Summer Circle Theater?
Absolutely. So this is part of, you know, MSU now, so it can be lots of things. I would imagine, why not have a wedding out there? But
that's a great idea.
Right, totally. So I think it can be used for lots of things, concerts, and obviously its connection so close to the art building, so there'll certainly be crossover in this arts corridor between the two buildings.
You can't wait.
I cannot wait. I'm very excited.
Yeah. Will the seating capacity be similar to what we have now?
Exactly. Yeah, the seating capacity, I think it'll be actually a little more intimate because those bleachers are so far back. But it'll be about 300 or 400 seats, and that's usually what we get each night at Summer Circle.
Rob Rosnowski of the MSU Department of Theater, great seeing you again. Good
great
luck with
you.
This year's Summer Circle, and we look forward to the new site next year.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. This past winter was one of the most brutal winters Michigan's ever seen, and unfortunately its impacts are still lingering. As people begin to plan their summer travels, there may be some residual effects from this winter. Joining us for a tourism forecast, Steve Jensich, President and CEO of Michigan's Lodging and Tourism Association. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mark.
How did the intense winter affect winter tourism? Did people head north to ski and snowmobile less or more?
Well, I often say that tourism is a little like squeezing a water balloon. If you squeeze here, it bulges out somewhere else.
Oh.
So in many cases,
I think that's good news.
Well, it's guardedly
hit,
good.
You take a hit in one place and it pays a dividend some other place.
Exactly. So some of the ski resorts reported kind of average results early in the season. We had the timing of the ice storm down here and some of the blizzards that would hit on Thursday and Friday evenings, which makes travel a little difficult. But on balance, as we proceeded through the winter, people got used to those hardy and cold temperatures and began to travel a lot more. So snowmobiling was up pretty much in the lower peninsula, but up in the upper peninsula, because you didn't have to drive that far for snow. Snowmobiling was down just a tad.
You anticipated my next question. You just didn't have to necessarily drive as far to get really good, intense, wintry conditions if you were a snowmobiler or ice fisherman or skier or anything, right?
Absolutely.
You could have stayed closer to home. And you saw that pan out in this past winter?
Yeah, very much so. People, I think gas is always a pressure point for travel and tourism. And people are always taking a look at the cost of gas as they make their travel plans, be it for the weekend or a vacation. So, yeah, it's an important factor.
It's easy enough to assume that there is more intrastate, more in-state tourism in winter than in summer. In other words, people are less likely to cross a state line to come to Michigan in the wintertime than in the summertime. Am I right about that?
That's absolutely the case. I mean, again, winter weather, cost of gas. We are second only to New York State for the number of ski hills and resorts that we have in this state. People think Colorado and out west, and that's where the really steep runs are. But there's plenty of things to do, plenty of ski runs in the state of Michigan. But you're right. Beyond the Great Lakes region, you're not going to see a lot of travel from other states during the winter.
I noticed this, too. Just voted number 2 in USA Today's poll for best U.S. island. I didn't even know there was such a category, but there is. Mackinac Island, number 2 in the best U.S. island category. Is Mackinac Island a big part of state tourism?
Oh, very much so. I mean, there's a host of vacation destinations that do great during the summer and year-round basis. Mackinac Island, because you get on that island, you never see a car. It's all horse-drawn carriages and bikes. Has that special appeal, I think, to many people. And it's on everyone's bucket list as a place to visit be there an in-state resident or from other states.
Do you know if visits to Mackinac Island are on the increase? Are they flat? Are they going down? Do we know?
You know, I don't know personally in terms of data, but I hear on a regular basis from folks on the island that basically anecdotally, travel and tourism is up in that destination, as it is on pretty much a statewide basis since the development of that award-winning Pure Michigan campaign.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. The Great Lakes did have some of the most ice coverage we've seen in a long time, if ever, this past winter. What effects has that specifically had on tourism? Do you see that having any effect on summer tourism?
You know, I think people, summer tourism in terms of heading to the Great Lakes beaches is always predicated on hot temperatures of 85 degrees or more in the downstate regions. Once you get to 90 degrees, we hop in our cars and we head up north and to those Great Lake beaches. But, you know, the unusually cold winter, the ice coverage that in some cases there's still ice floating around in Lake Superior. I'm not joking. It's true. And so, you know, the water temperature is going to be, I just saw a news report indicated that water temperature in the middle of Lake Michigan as of just yesterday, 36 degrees. So it's going to be a while for that reservoir of water to warm up to summer temperatures. So if you're really, really hot, go take a dip, but make it quick.
Well, but your point was if the temperatures are warm enough in the summertime, people head to water. They head north. But it sounds like they might be Superior might even be a little colder than it ordinarily is. See, Superior to me is freezing even when it's been a mild winter.
Yeah, very much so. A couple of years ago, it was an uncharacteristically warmer winter, and I actually went swimming for distance in Lake Superior in late August.
Wow.
So I think that's the exception. It's certainly not the norm. It's going to, you know, you won't have to go swimming necessarily to get the relief of those hot, humid temperatures downstate.
Steve Jensich is our guest here on Current State. He is the president and CEO of Michigan's Lodging and Tourism Association. To what extent does Michigan rely on tourism revenue, Steve?
You know, undoubtedly, it's become a much more important factor in recent years. We've always been historically the third largest industry in the state. And however, we are the one industry that is most prone to consumer confidence, to economic swings. I mean, I've always said it's one thing to consider taking your wife and family or your spouse and family out to eat during an economic downturn. It's another thing entirely to say I'm going to go up to Traverse City or Mackinac Island and incur lodging, entertainment, and meals on top of that. So discretionary income is an important factor, but we are definitely on the rebound these last few years.
And economically, would you say, we do hear good news economically, incrementally over time. Your forecasts suggest a pretty strong season for Michigan tourism operators?
Yeah. I mean, again, based on the performance of that Pure Michigan ad campaign, the most recent studies have found every dollar invested in that award-winning campaign generate over $6.50 in new taxes, new revenues to the state of Michigan. And so, you know, there was a time when the in-state resident base provided 70% of total tourism outcomes. Now it's very much the opposite. The preponderance of those outcomes are being generated by people coming into the state of Michigan.
And in from other countries. There is an international dimension to the Pure Michigan campaign now, correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, thanks to the governor's support and the legislature agreeing with him, there's been additional monies targeted towards international tourism, specifically on the Canadian market and Toronto. It's a nearby market, but it's very important to our state, and so we're seeing great performance there. Pure Michigan has offices along with a consortium of other Great Lakes states in Great Britain and Germany. And then back before George Zimmerman left, he joined the governor on a trade trip to China. So we're looking for stronger and stronger performance out of the international market in coming years.
Is it too early to assess that now?
I think so. And again, the association, we don't have access to that kind of data. That's probably a Travel Michigan kind of question. But again, anecdotally, as we talk to our members and we find out who's coming to visit, they have property management systems and they can track the point of origin for all their guests. That international market is beginning to respond.
What are some of the top tourist destinations in Michigan. We mentioned Mackinac Island. Aside from Mackinac Island, what are the others that really deliver in terms of popularity?
Now, remembering I'm the state association director, I want to kind of crawl under the table.
You can't play favorites.
Have no favorites officially, Mark. But, just Detroit's the number one destination in this state.
Yeah.
Frankenmuth's a great destination. One of the great undiscovered assets that we have is that whole sunrise side of the east side of the state, Lake Huron shoreline. Of course, the Gold Coast is the west coast of Michigan, and the UP is one of those great secrets that they just made a top 10 list for great places to visit nationwide. So, we are blessed with assets that no other state have, primarily because of the Great Lakes. So there's just so many destinations, so many great things to do.
Is there a connection, Steve, between real estate prices and Michigan tourism as property values go up and down in upper Michigan, let's say? Do you see any kind of dynamic there between that and the number of people who visit, or is there not a connection there?
Oh, very decidedly a very strong, compelling connection. You have to come and visit and vacation and kind of test drive this state before you decide to perhaps purchase a second home or perhaps relocate. Part of MEDC's message, and Travel Michigan is housed in MEDC, is to bring new businesses and industry to the state. And people, upon visiting and vacationing here, are realizing it's a great place to live, great lifestyle, great opportunities, and it really goes hand in hand. Tourism goes hand in hand with economic development.
And we've just got a few seconds. Was the Memorial Day weekend a strong one? Do you know?
Anecdotally, based on my communications with our members, it was a very strong weekend, great weather, and we're always happy to see that.
So a decent start to the season. Steve Jensich is president and CEO of Michigan's Lodging and Tourism Association. Have a great summer, Steve.
Thanks so much.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll preview the World Cup and learn more about Michigan's native plants. That and more Wednesday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. The producer of Current State is Joe Lindstroth. Many thanks, Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Thank you, Aaron Young, for engineering, and Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.